Judges chapter 4 and 5 this evening, two chapters all in one go. We'll be spending most of our time in Judges 4, but what we'll find is that Judges 5, Deborah's song, it gives us an insight into what's happening that will help us understand the story. So we'll be referencing chapter 5 at various points as we go through. Now, back in 2002, the BBC ran a poll of the greatest Britons of all time. And you know who came top? Greatest Briton of all time? You can probably get, I think I heard someone say it. Churchill. It was Winston Churchill. Churchill's recognised as one of the greatest Prime Ministers of Britain, over the history of Britain, isn't he? Determined in the face of the enemy. We think of his moving speeches, we will fight them on the beaches and so on. Churchill hauled the country over the line to victory, and great leaders do that, don't they? They inspire people to do great, courageous acts. It's what great leaders do, but bad leaders can cause great damage as well. But then there's something else very damaging, which is no leadership, just a void, no one stepping up to lead. And what we're going to see is that there is a void of leadership in Judges 4 and 5. Now the context here is that as God is raising up judges, the judges, I don't know if you've noticed, are normally men. Deborah here is the exception. All the others are men. And historically, the judges in the Bible are men. You know who the first judge in the Bible was? The first great judge is Moses. So you read through Exodus chapter 18, and Moses there, we're told, sits in the seat of judgment. People come to him to bring their cases and ask him. Moses is the initial judge. You think back further than that, you go back to the garden. Adam was created first, and then Eve. When God raises up kings, he calls men to be kings. You go into the New Testament church, and God says that elders, those who are called to shepherd the flock, are to be men. You see the pattern there. God says in the marriage relationship, husbands are called to lead, to be the head of the house. It's because God gives male and female different roles to play. You can see the pattern there, just that broad sweep. Now that doesn't mean that every man is the head of every woman. That's, some people will say that, and that's just not the case at all. But there are those specific roles I've just mentioned, the role of being a king, the role of being a husband or a father or an elder. And God calls men to those roles. So when you come across Deborah here, you think, whoa, something interesting is happening in this chapter. Now some people, for many people, just to hear that much, to hear what I've said so far, that's enough for some people to conclude that means God must be a sexist, a misogynist. But it comes from a misunderstanding of what it means to be a head. A man being a head, for example, of a household, a man being the head of his wife, doesn't mean he's superior in any way. It doesn't mean he gets to treat her badly as a slave or anything like that. We're just talking here about different roles that God gives his people. The reason I can say with confidence that there's nothing inferior going on here is that in 1 Corinthians 11 it says that just as the head of a wife is her husband, the head of Jesus Christ is God. And there's nothing disrespectful about that with Jesus, is there? Jesus isn't humiliated. He's not being disrespected. He's not being told he's inferior or stupid because God the Father is his head. It's just Jesus has a different role to play to that of his Father. So this, the whole concept of having heads, there's nothing humiliating about it. It's just a different role to play because Jesus has a head. Now, in the days of the judges, one of the roles of the Levites was to judge. But as we're going to find, they're nowhere to be found in this chapter. They're just not mentioned. In fact, the men are not to be found full stop in this chapter. We read in chapter 5 in Deborah's song, this sort of sums up, I think, so much of the people. In chapter 5, verse 8, they'd chosen you gods, and there was war in the gates. Not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. Where are the warriors? Where are those carrying their shields and spears? There's not a single one of them. Judges chapter 4 is about two women who step up to the mark and lead in the absence of those who should have been doing it. They take on the leadership of the nation, that's Deborah, and they take on the leadership of the army, that's Jael. She becomes a warrior, if you like. So the women take on these positions in this story, and on the flip side, the two men we're going to read about, they're not real men at all. They don't lead. So this story is a story of what happens when men act like boys, when they just refuse to lead, when they're completely absent. So let's get stuck into the text. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. The scene is set, and if you've been with us previous Sunday evenings, you'll recognise it, those first three verses. Death, disobedience, distress. So Ehud dies, the first thing we're told. The children of Israel do evil, they disobey, they're sold into hands. This time it's Jabin, the king of Canaan, a different leader. He has Sisera, the commander of his army. The children of Israel cry out to the Lord again. They're in distress. And the rest of the chapter is concerned with the fourth D, the deliverance. But it's going to be deliverance at the hand of Deborah and Jael. So we're going to think firstly about Deborah, and then we're going to think about Jael. That's our structure. And Deborah is in verses 4 to 17. So Deborah the judge. Verse 4, we're introduced to Deborah. We're told she's a prophetess, so when she's speaking a bit later on, hasn't the Lord said, well, she's able to prophesy. She's able to speak on God's behalf. We're told she'd sit under a palm tree, and that palm tree's actually been named after her. It's called the Palm Tree of Deborah. And that people will come to her for judgment. So if there's difficult decisions, there's disputes, they'll take them to Deborah and she will judge on them. We're told she would sit for judgment, and that it's the same language used of Moses. Moses would sit for judgment as well. So I think the point we're meant to notice there is that she's sitting in the seat of Moses as the head judge of Israel. And you notice just as reading this, the writer pains to tell us that Deborah's a woman. He wants this to come out again and again. He tells us she's a prophetess, makes the point of telling us that she's married, she's the wife of a man named Lapidoth. Gender is at the forefront of this whole story. And notice in verse 6, she calls for Barak, the son of Abinoam. He doesn't come to him, he doesn't summon her, she summons him. And she tells him what to do. She reminds him what God has commanded. She says, look, don't you remember what he said? Go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor. Take your 10,000 men, and I'll deploy Sisera, and I'll deliver him into your hand. Notice verse 8, Barak's response. He doesn't want to go by himself. Barak, I think, he wants mummy to hold his hand. Says, I'll only go if you go with me. That's what Barak has to say. In chapter 5, verse 7, where Deborah's singing this song, verse 7, she describes herself as a mother in Israel. I think the picture we're meant to see here with Barak is that she is mothering Barak. Barak's like this little boy who won't take the lead, and he needs mummy to go with him and hold his hand. He'll only go if Deborah goes with her. So in verse 9 she says, okay, I'll go with you, but you won't receive any of the glory yourself. He's not going to come home full of everyone praising him. He says instead a woman will receive the glory. That's what she's told. She tells him in verse 9. And at that stage you think, well, that's probably going to be Deborah, isn't it? But there's a twist to the tale. So verses 9 and 10, off they go. Barak has these 10,000 men under his command, but I think we know who's really in charge here, and it's not Barak, it's Deborah. She's the one who's taking the lead here. In verse 11, we're told that Heber the Kenite has just moved. He's pitched his tent somewhere else. And at this stage, that almost just seems this random detail. You think, well, why is he telling us that? But we'll see as we go through the story that he's married to Jael. He's going to play a big part here. In verses 12 and 13, Sisera gathers together his 900 chariots of iron. If you remember back in chapter 1, the people of Israel say to God, look, we can't defeat anyone who has chariots of iron. Chariots of iron are too big, too strong, too tough. And there's a sense in which, humanly speaking, 900 chariots of iron would defeat 10,000 foot soldiers every single time. So that's what he's got. He's got 900 chariots of iron. Notice then in verse 14, who is it that issues the battle cry? It's not Barak, the commander of the army, who issues it. It's Deborah who says, come on now, up and at them. This is the day. The Lord's gone out before you. Isn't he going to give Sisera into your hands? So off they go, but it's Deborah who issues the cry and summons Barak onto the battlefield. So off they go, and in verse 15, we're told the Lord routed Sisera. The word routed there literally means caused confusion. And it's a word that was usually used about storms, sending the rain, that sort of confusion. Again, in Deborah's song, if you look at chapter 5, verse 21, Deborah tells us that's what actually happened, where she says, the torrents of Kishon swept them away. So what happened on the battlefield? The rain came down, and the torrents swept the enemy away. Presumably the chariots couldn't move. They were caught in the mud. And I'm guessing that's why in verse 15, Sisera gets off his chariot and he flees on foot. So in verse 16, the Israelites chase them down and kill them. Now we're told very clearly how all this has happened. It's the Lord who routed Sisera. God does all this stuff. But who did he use? Well, he's using Deborah here, isn't he? She's the one who's grabbed this situation by the scruff of the neck and made things happen. She's taken the lead. Barak would never have done it himself. He said as much, hasn't he? He said, I'm not going to go unless you, Deborah, come with me. After when you read these sorts of stories, you're left with so many questions you really want to know the answer to. So many things I'd love to ask Deborah. Was she a reluctant judge? There she is, sitting there in this seat, judging. Did she want to? Did she sort of end up feeling, well, I better have to because no one else is doing it because the people need a judge? Was there a part of her that just wished she didn't have to? I don't know. There's so many questions we'd like to ask her about her feelings, her motivation, but we're just not given that. I think what we're going to say is she's acting because there's something that needs to be done, and things that honour the Lord. I think we're meant to see her very positively. With Barak, I don't know about you, I don't think he comes across very well. He comes across as a bit of a wimp, but we need to be careful not to go too far in that direction and write him off, because actually, well, partly I suspect most of us are like him. Most of us, we want to do the right thing, but we want someone to help us and go with us. God doesn't write him off either, and it's Barak who comes up in Hebrews 11 in the hall of faith. He's described as a man of faith, which means he is acting in faith in this story, even though he's scared and nervous and not very courageous in some ways. That's Deborah the judge. Secondly, we're going to look at Jael the warrior. And after they do that, we're going to draw out one main lesson for us to take home. So Jael the warrior is verses 17 to 24. So the rain has come down, Sisera gets off his chariot, he starts to leg it on foot, and he reaches, we're told, in verse 17, the tent of Jael. This is our second woman who plays a leading role in this story. Again, notice verse 17, we're told she has a husband. But he's not going to do anything to Sisera because we're told he's made peace with King Jael. That's verse 17 again. So presumably Sisera thinks this is somewhere I'm going to be safe because I've got this, you know, we've got this treaty, if you like, with him. So in verse 18, she encourages him to come in. She says, don't be afraid. Come on in. It'll be okay here. And what does she do after that? There are two lines of thought that are worth mentioning here. I think it's quite possible that actually both of these are true. The first common thought is that she draws him into a sexual encounter. Jewish writers from the early days, so many centuries ago, Jewish writers in the Talmud, which is a document, you know, many, many hundreds of years old, thousands of years old, where they rabbis would write about these sorts of events. That's how they saw it. They saw this as a story that's full of euphemisms for sexual activity. That's how they interpreted it, and obviously their knowledge of the language is much better than ours. So for example, in verse 19, when it says she covered him, the Talmud says what that's a euphemism for is she covered him with her body. And that she does this, she lures him in as a way of getting him, getting him into the tent, getting him settled down, and then falling asleep. Now that may well be correct, but what I think as well is quite possible, and again, it could just be that there's an element of both these things, is that this is another example of a woman playing a mothering type role to another boy type figure. Sisera is meant to be this leader, this warrior, the commander of the army, but he comes in and she pulls the wool over his eyes. We're told she covers him with a blanket. Picture, she just like mummies do, she's tucking him up all nice and warm under a blanket in bed. He asks for water, but she gives him some milk. And Deborah picks up on that in her song. She clearly thinks there's some significance in the fact that she gives him some milk. To me, I think that sounds like, you know, just like infants have for their bottle of milk at bedtime. She tucks him up in bed under the blanket, gives him his milk, and off he goes to sleep. Because he feels safe there. She's made him feel safe and secure. Just like when children are worried at night about the monsters who might get them. But mummy's able to calm them down. It's okay, I'm right here. They're not going to come and get you. So off they go to sleep. She's made him feel very safe and secure there. You would have thought, wouldn't you, that the adrenaline would be pumping so hard him at this point. He's just been on the battlefield. He's fled for his life. I sort of think, I'm not sure I'd sleep for ages after that. But, you know, she's obviously calmed him down a lot here. And then when he falls asleep, she creeps up to him with this tent peg. One of the woman's role in those days was to put up and take down the tent. So to do this deed with a tent peg, I guess it's sort of the equivalent of killing someone with a knitting needle. Excuse me if there are male knitters here tonight, but I'm trying to think of a commonly female sort of thing. She drives it through his head into the ground, and he dies, we're told. So at that point, the barrack turns up. Verse 22, she tells him, look, I can show you Sisera. And I wonder if even at this point, Barak's still hoping he might get some of the glory. And he goes and he can grab Sisera and take him home. But then she takes him in and he's already been killed. He's already dead. And so what Deborah the prophet said was true. The glory here is going to go to a woman. With bearing in mind here, in their culture, it was particularly shameful to be killed by a woman. So if you can flick over a few pages to chapter 9, verse 54, where a woman drops a millstone on Abimelech's head. His first thought is to call his armor bearer to him to kill him quickly. And the reason he gives is because I don't want anyone to be able to say that a woman killed me. That was the culture. That's how they felt. So this is a humiliating way for Sisera to end. He wouldn't have liked this if he'd have known about it. Now again, I was saying the same about this about Deborah. Same with Jael. There are questions you'd love to ask her, wouldn't you? You'd love to be able to get inside her head. Why did she kill him? What's her motive for doing that? I remember being in a Bible study years ago, going through this passage, and one of the people talking with I remember talking to her about this afterwards, and she said, this is a retired pastor's wife, I remember her saying, "Well, I just think that jail's a nasty piece of work." For some reason, that phrase always stuck with me. And when I hear jail, I think nasty piece of work. And at the time, I agreed. And I thought, yeah, it does just seem almost perverse, doesn't it, to kill someone like this? And you start thinking, is she some sort of psychopath? What is, what could make her do something like this? You read some of the commentaries on this, and it describes her as treacherous, deceitful, because she lured him in a deceitful way. That's the view quite a lot of people take. I don't know. I don't know what she was thinking. But if I had to choose, that's not the way I would go. And I think that's what the writer wants us to see. There's various hints that we're given. So, for example, back in verse 11, why are we told that Heber the Kenite has a link to Moses? I suspect it's that Jael knows something about more than we perhaps give her credit for. She has links to Moses and the people of God. You look at Deborah's song. How does Deborah interpret this? Look at verse 24, chapter 5, verse 24. She praises Jael. Most blessed among women is Jael. Blessed is she among women in tents. Deborah goes on in her song to say, to remind us, what would have happened if Sisera hadn't been killed, if he'd won the battle? You look at the end of the chapter, verse 28, you've got this picture of Sisera's mother looking through the window. It's a very sort of picturesque scene, this sort of forlorn looking through the window. Where is my dear Sisera? When's he going to come back from the battlefield? Notice there's another mother here in the story. I think we're meant to see these mother type images all the way through. So she's crying. But notice when her wise ladies comfort her in verse 29. And then verse 30, notice what they say. Are they not finding and dividing the spoil to every man a girl or two? You see what that phrase means? They're dividing the spoil. What would Sisera and the other people in the army do when they win a victory over a nation? They divide the spoil. They take home the plunder. But what is the plunder? To every man, a girl or two. Every man gets to take home one or two girls. What for? Well, to be sex slaves. That's what they did. This is the Canaanites we're talking about. Maybe, just maybe again, we don't know how much Jael knows here. But I'd like to take the view that she's got a sense of righteousness here. And that she can see this man for who she really is. That he's a wicked Canaanite man. That God's commanded these wicked people to be put to death. And God is using her in this. Again, the big picture here. Sisera, this commander of the army, becomes like a little boy. And Jael, the warrior, a foreign woman, the warrior who takes the scalp of this commander. There's one lesson we're going to draw out of this story. This is all about leadership. The lesson is this: real good leadership is vital. Now, on one side of the story, we've got this, that weak or absent leadership is a sign of God's judgment. Now, even if we see Deborah, Barak and Jael all as heroes, as people of faith, which is sort of what I'm suggesting, although I'm saying that I can't prove some things sometimes. I'm presenting them to you in that way. Even if we see them that way, their leadership is still an indictment on the nation of Israel. I'll give you an example of this. Isaiah chapter 3, verse 3. The Lord there is telling Israel how he's going to judge them for their unfaithfulness. Isaiah 3, verse 3, I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. And again, carrying on, Isaiah 3, verse 12, as for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. The very fact that they're being led by Deborah, a woman, Barak, this sort of man-child who needs her to hold his hand, and jail a foreigner. It's a sign of just how far things have gone wrong. And that is the big sweep of the book of Judges. Everyone just does what's right in their own eyes. Now, we're not blaming them. We're not pointing the finger at Deborah or Jael. Actually, the point of this story is the finger is pointed squarely at those who should have stepped up to lead and didn't. These chapters are all about the blessing of leaders who lead, and then equally what happens when there's no real leadership. That's how Deborah sees this in her song. Look at how she starts her song in chapter 5, verse 2. The first thing she says, "When leaders lead in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord." So again, chapter 5, verse 9, "My heart is with the rulers of Israel who offered themselves willingly with the people." She's praising leaders who lead. Still in chapter 5, verses 13 to 15, she lists some of the tribes who came to fight. Ephraim, Benjamin, Zebulun, and so on. Then the second half of verse 15 through to verse 17, she calls out some of the tribes who stayed at home. She says, "Reuben just sat there among the sheepfolds, listening to the pipings for the flocks." And she says, "Gilead just stayed beyond the Jordan. Dan remained on the ships. They didn't stand up and fight there when they were needed. They just stayed at home." The fact that Deborah and Jael have had to stand up here and fight and lead, it's not an indictment on them. It's an indictment on the men of Israel, because they become a nation full of boys. And what was needed was men, those who would lead. When you see Sisera being mothered by Jael, what I think we're meant to see here is that the men of Israel have become like the men of Canaan. In previous weeks we've described just how awful the Canaanites were, the wicked things they do. Just told you about how the Canaanites would take home sex slaves and all the other things they would do. I think the point again here is, you've become just like them. Now there are applications here we can make to our society and our government. I'm going to do it in a completely non-political way, if you like. Wherever, and I'm leaving this for you to decide, to assess our own government, by the way. This is a general point. When you see leadership that is weak, foolish, indecisive, ungodly, we do have to ask ourselves, like those people of Israel, has this nation been given the leaders you deserve? Saying about that verse about children being given to rule over Israel. Well, we don't have children ruling over us. I should have looked this up. Have we ever had? Well, I suppose we've had children who were monarchs in our country centuries ago, haven't we? Again, it's interesting to know, and you can make of this what you will, that. That three of the four last prime ministers we've voted for have been very young, relatively speaking. They've been in their 40s. Again, you can decide what you want to make of that. I'm not making any comment, but God does say youthful leadership isn't to be commended. So we can try and draw out applications to society and government, but actually the main application here has to be for us. So for the final couple of minutes, I've got a question to ask the men, and then I've got a question to ask the women. The men first. Men, the question is a very simple one. Are you leading? Husbands, are you leading your wives? Are you leading her in godliness, in faithfulness? Are you setting an example of what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ? Are you leading in wisdom? What sort of example are you setting? Fathers, are you leading your children? bringing them up to know the Lord, investing time in teaching them all the things that God has shown you and revealed to them. You're investing in that way. And you're doing it as Jesus Christ did, as a servant leader, saying, it's not about what I want. What I want doesn't matter. My desires come second. I'll only do what's best for my wife. That's what it means to be a servant leader like Jesus Christ. Men, do you aspire to be an elder or a deacon? Do you know that's a good aspiration? A sense in which I'd say that should be the aim of every man. Because the list of qualifications, apart from teaching, isn't about our gifts, it's about our character. Do you want that sort of character, men? The sort of character that the church recognises? You're aspiring to lead. Read that list of qualifications. Men, are you leading? Question for women as well. I should say this, by the way, I'm putting out general principles here, but the way we work these things through will differ, and there'll be all sorts of different situations to apply this to, but I'm putting out general principles. Women, question for you is this. Are you encouraging the men in your life to lead? Because sometimes, like you read about in Judges, men don't lead as they should. And the easy thing to do sometimes is just do it yourself. You need to see women, the example that Deborah gives for us here, that she doesn't lead the army into the battle herself, which I think she would have been very capable of doing. She's judging the whole of Israel. Notice what she does instead. She summons Barak. She says, come on, Barak. Up you get. Off you go. She reminds Barak of God's promises. Come on, the Lord will be with you. He's going to rout Sisera. Wives, are you encouraging your husbands to lead, to care, to serve? Women, are you encouraging the men who have been called? In fact, this isn't just for the women, this is for everyone. Are you encouraging the men you've called to lead the church here to serve and to lead? We've got a friend who met a Christian man. There's a girl we know, and she wanted to think, they were going to think very seriously about getting married and getting to know each other. But she was a much more mature Christian than he was. She'd been a Christian a lot longer. She'd been brought up in a Christian home. She'd been to a church where she was well taught. But he hadn't. He was converted from an unbelieving background. Hadn't had very good teaching. She was just a far more mature Christian than he was. And it would have been so easy for her. We were sort of looking on. We were talking about things. It would have been so easy for her just to take the lead. To make the decision. You know, to do all the things that a leader does in a marriage. And she set such a wonderful example as we watched on as they went through this process, and now they're married, of consciously encouraging him to take the lead. And as a married couple, it's wonderful to see he does that now. He's grown, he's matured, and she's helped him. She's got a lot to, you know, we thank her for what she's done there. Women, is that your aim for the men in your life, to encourage them to take the lead? Well, those are general principles. The way we work these things out, well, if you feel free to talk to me afterwards if you're not sure what this means for you and your situation. But let me just close by echoing what Deborah says about leadership in her song. She sings, when leaders lead in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord. When we see that, when we see leaders leading, when we see people offering themselves, that's a reason to rejoice and sing, just like Deborah does. Notice the model of leadership she gives us. Those two phrases Deborah gives there, we combine and we see perfectly in the one man, Jesus Christ, who's a leader who leads, and someone who willingly offers himself as well, offering himself for others, taking up the cross so others can live. That's real leadership. If you're ever in doubt about what leadership looks like, look at Jesus Christ. It's the type of leadership we should aspire to and pray for. Praise God, he sent his one perfect leader. See, ultimately, this story isn't actually about Deborah or Jael or Barak or anyone like that. Again and again, we're told in this story that it's the Lord's doing, that it's the Lord who's going to deliver Sisera. It's the Lord who's going to be with Barak. The great message here is that God is going to save his people, and he's going to do it in his own unexpected way yet again here, choosing unexpected people, even someone like Jael, who just comes out of left field. It does mean we can re-quote Deborah's words with much greater meaning. When Deborah says, "My heart is with the rulers of Israel who offered themselves willingly with the people," and say, "My heart is with that one great ruler of Israel who did what none of those rulers ever could. He offered himself willingly for his people." So that's what being a servant leader is. Jesus gives us the perfect example of that. We're going to sing our final song now, which is all about that. Number 167, Meekness and Majesty, those two things combined.